Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump Monday night nominated Brett Kavanaugh to a lifetime seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. The 53-year-old Kavanaugh is a conservative member of the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and a lifelong Beltway denizen, the product of prep schools and an Ivy League education. Coming up, we'll hear from constitutional scholars about the changing face of the court and what issues could be affected at this point. Joining us now by phone is Columbus Dispatch D.C. Bureau Chief Jack Torrey. Welcome back, Jack.
Glad to be here.
So we know the nominee, finally. It was very exciting, a lot of build up to that. What's the feeling in Washington?
Well, the reaction was very predictable. Kavanaugh, on paper, has sterling credentials. He's a graduate of Yale Law School. He worked in the George W. Bush White House. He has been on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals for the past dozen years, which is always considered an area, a stepping stone to the Supreme Court. He is provoking intense opposition from Senate Democrats, who are fearful that he will scale back. He will be a fifth vote to scale back women's reproductive rights based under the 1992 Casey decision and, of course, the 1973 decision Roe v. Wade. So I think you're going to see a lot of noise, a lot of bells and whistles and everything else, but absent anything coming out of his background that we don't know about, and right now he appears to be a Boy Scout, I see him probably getting confirmed with about 51 to 54 votes.
It could be tight, though, and that issue of reproductive rights is at the heart of that, right?
Yes, the Democrats are making that the, I guess you could call it Custer's last stand. I really don't have a lot of sympathy for them because they could have solved this problem in 2016 by not nominating the one person Donald Trump could beat. I think had Joe Biden been the nominee, the Democrats would have filled these two seats. But that be that as it may, elections have consequences. Mm-hmm. Trump won the election. He gets to fulfill his pick who he wants. And if the Senate Republicans confirm him, then he's on the court.
He, as you mentioned, was working for the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration. That did worry some far-right observers?
I think there were most of that came from social conservatives and from those who are distrustful of big power presidents. Kavanaugh's writings have suggested he believes that the executive, the presidential power is something that can be expanded. Yeah. For example, he does not believe that a president should have to be, deal with court battles on civil cases and things of that nature. And he has a very good reason. The president of the United States is a very unique position, and taking time out to testify in civil depositions is probably not the smartest use of their time. He also voted against the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He argued that, which was at that time headed by Richard Cordray, now the Democratic gubernatorial nominee. Mm-hmm. He argued that the system where you had a single director as opposed to a five-member board was unconstitutional because it put too much power in the hands of an unelected director and took away the authority of the president to fire that person. So I think you'll see him stick with that. I think he's very, very set in his ways on presidential authority.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court. President Trump announced it last night. Now the rest of us get to talk about it for a time before and then when the Senate gets underway with its confirmation hearings, that'll add another layer to the cake. My guest is Jack Torrey. He is D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment about this topic today, we welcome your thoughts, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Glad you brought up Rich Cordray. The Columbus Dispatch reported today that Brett Kavanaugh has contributed to campaigns in the far past before his Consumer Financial Protection Bureau days. But still, they were classmates, was it right? Am I right? Or fellow clerks?
They both clerked for Justice Kennedy.
That's right.
I don't know if they clerked at the exact same time, but they both came out of the same clerkship there. And he's an extremely qualified person. That doesn't mean that that makes him an automatic confirmation. But people know him in Washington. They have a high respect for his legal skills. And I think he's a little more in the nature of John Roberts than he is Samuel Alito.
Hmm.
But he really does.
And tell us what that means to you.
Well, I think he's a little more cautious. He might be a little more cautious. This is really, you're trying to read how a justice is going to act 10 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Roberts is very, very, very cautious, except for the overturning of Abood, which was the public employee union case. Roberts tends to not want to overturn a lot of precedent. And I think he'll find an ally there with Kavanaugh, whereas Alito and Thomas, I don't think they care a hoot about precedent whatsoever.
Huh.
And so as a result, I think you'll see him at the beginning being a fairly strong ally with Roberts. They both come out of the same Bush administration. They're very conservative. I mean, don't kid yourself about that. This mm-hmm. man is a conservative judge. But I think he's also there's an indication there's some caution there. So we will find that out.
Let's talk about the confirmation process and how it will unfold. When is it supposed to get underway on the Senate Judiciary?
Well, as we speak right now, Mitch McConnell is giving a news conference where he's talking about this very thing. My guess is in either August or early September, you'll see confirmation hearings. And if the Republicans have their way, they will get a floor vote before the November elections. And if that's the case, I think they have the votes because there are three Democrats from very conservative states, one by Trump, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Donnelly from Indiana, Heidekamp from Montana. And I think that they are going to be very reluctant to oppose Kavanaugh on the grounds of abortion. I think the Democrats are probably walking into a little bit of a trap here because it's always a mistake to make your stand on one issue such as abortion rights, which is a very divisive issue. You might have a situation in the fall where the Republicans are talking about the economy and the Democrats are talking about abortion rights. And I think that might work to the Republican advantages.
Mm-hmm.
We will see. My guess is, absent some horrendous thing, he will be confirmed. And I think they're very. 40 years ago, they didn't put this emphasis on getting their background right. So Eisenhower named Earl Warren and William Brennan to the bench and really had no idea what they were going to do when they became on the Supreme Court. The old joke is he said, I made two mistakes as president, and they're both sitting on the Supreme Court. but today, both sides are preferring to nominate people who've been on the appellate courts, who have a proven background. They kind of can predict where they'll go. But even then, you know, once they get on that lifetime appointment, mm-hmm. you just can't guarantee where they're going to go. An example would be Justice Roberts. Chief Justice Roberts upheld the Affordable Care Act. Yeah, by one vote, and he did it on a very actually conservative basis. He said, well, the law isn't very good, but Congress has the right to do stupid things, and so they did it.
Let's talk about, you know, what you see the impact would be on the midterms at this point. Does it matter if he's confirmed before or after the midterms?
It would matter only if the Republicans lost control of the Senate, which is a possibility. I mean, I think this is setting up right now.
And then they could make an argument to wait until after the new Senate is seated.
Right. That's what the Democrats have essentially taken the Republican talking points from 2016, mm-hmm. which is, well, we need to wait until the elections, okay? And so they have adopted the let's wait. Well, that's just not going to happen. There'll be a vote before the midterms. And I just, you know, it's how many votes you got, and the Democrats don't have the votes in the Senate to stop this absent something really horrendous. And, you know, the problem, too, is people say, well, the confirmation hearings, they'll ask tough questions. Senators don't ask tough questions at these hearings. They tend to read speeches and, you know, and go on from there. But they're not real good at asking questions. And so I don't see that as being, you know, there'll be, again, it'll be a big TV show. But if Kavanaugh follows the lead of Roberts and Alito, he'll simply say, look, I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to vote because I don't know how I'm going to vote yet.
As far as this might not be the last for Trump, the other member, the more liberal wing of the court is the aging wing of the court.
That is true, and my guess is they're not going to go voluntarily, neither Breyer nor Ginsburg. And but it makes the vote for president so important. And in this instance, to the Democrats, they should be looking at themselves and going, "How did we screw this up?" I mean, they lost to a guy who got 46% of the vote. And at least more than half the country didn't like. And that's a hard thing to do. And in part, it's because they nominated the wrong candidate. I mean, Hillary Clinton may have been a fine Secretary of State, but she was a dreadful presidential candidate. And you know, these choices have come back to haunt the Democrats. And now, of course, the Democrats are into this argument about that socialism is a good idea, even though nobody can come up with any examples where it's absolutely worked well. And so the divisions right now are among the Democrats, and it may hurt them in the off-year elections. Hmm.
Jack Torrey, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Glad to be with you, Van.
Jack Torrey, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. More on the topic of the United States Supreme Court with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh last night by President Donald Trump. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Trump has nominated a well-known conservative judge from the United States Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit. Any Trump nominee would likely push the court further right. Brett Kavanaugh likely would fit that bill. Joining us is Ohio State Constitutional Law Professor Mark Spindleman. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me on. It's nice to be here.
And by phone, American University Washington College of Law Professor Steve Wormiel. Steve also covered the Supreme Court for the Wall Street Journal for several years. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
If approved, or if confirmed, I should say, Brett Kavanaugh will push the Supreme Court more firmly to the right because it's expected that he will eliminate that precious swing vote has been, you know, his predecessor or his potential predecessor, Anthony Kennedy, is known for, right, Mark Spindleman?
Well, it's Justice Kennedy is and has been for some time known as the swing justice on the court, the one who sort of tilts the balance either in a more conservative or a more liberal direction. And his departure raises a question about who will then be at the center of the court. There's a question about whether it might be the Chief Justice, John Roberts. And now there's a question about whether it's going to be Roberts and or Kavanaugh.
Okay, so you're seeing he could be a center.
Well, I mean, I don't. It's too soon. It's too soon to tell we don't know whether he's going to actually be on the court.
Of course,
we've got a big process, so I don't want to get ahead of it. But there's a possibility that the Chief Justice will be at the center, and Kavanaugh might be, you know, sort of slightly to his right. I think it's fair to say that Kavanaugh would be more conservative than Justice Kennedy. And so either way, the swinging center of the court shifts to the right, shifts in a more conservative direction with the departure of Justice Kennedy.
Hmm. What do you think, Steve Ormeal?
I agree with Mark, but I would add some adverbs to his comments. I would say extremely. I think that Kavanaugh is a very conservative judge, smart, respected, accomplished, but extremely conservative. And the idea of a swing vote is almost out the door. I mean, Roberts, I think, becomes the middle of the court just because somebody is the middle of the court, not because he's likely to vote often with the more liberal wing of the court. If somebody in the five-member conservative majority is likely to say, I don't want to go quite that far, it might be Roberts. But I don't think that's going to be on the same scale as Kennedy or O'Connor or Powell before them. I think we're talking about a very conservative court.
Why? What do we know about Brett Kavanaugh that tells us he's very conservative, extremely conservative?
His background and his decisions on the D.C. Circuit. There are a few examples on the D.C. Court of Appeals where he has showed what might be called judicial restraint, where he didn't go as far as conservatives might have liked him to go in the Affordable Care Act case, in some other cases. But for the most part, he's been very challenging of the authority of independent agencies in the federal government. He's been very kind of suspect, I would say, of the right to abortion, of judge-created rights. I think he has a very narrow view of the role of the Supreme Court and of courts generally, which is a kind of hallmark of conservative judges.
He's also been mentioned as having strong feelings about executive authority, presidential authority, presidential powers. Why is that? Mark Spindleman, do we know about that?
Well, I take it that it's opinions that he's written while he's been on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, mm-hmm. indicating...
kind of the next second most powerful court in the country, right?
Yeah.
And as far as challenging the authority of independent agencies, are you referring, Steve Ormeal, to... among other things, is challenging the authority of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency or Protection Bureau that was most, you know, former clerk, fellow clerk of his, Rich Cordray, was the director of?
That's one, and certainly a high profile fight that is still going on and will continue. But he's written a number of opinions in which he's questioned whether agencies from the Environmental Protection Agency to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission had the authority to issue rules or make decisions that they were making, and taking the view that we ought not to be broadly deferring to the authority of those agencies.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the nominee to the United States Supreme Court. My guests are Mark Spindleman. He's a professor of law for the Moritz College of Law at OSU, and also Stephen Ormeal. He is a professor in constitutional law and associate director of the Summer Institute of Law and Government at American University Washington College of Law. have questions for our guests, thoughts, observations, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Roe v. Wade, that's what everyone's talking about, what everyone has been talking about since Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. Mark Spindleman, where does that rate on your list of issues that could go before the court that will be affected by this decision?
Well, Justice Kennedy's departure from the Supreme Court understandably raises a very important issue in question about what the future of reproductive rights under the Roe line of decisions will look like going forward. Whether there's a question about whether the court will slowly, incrementally cut back on those with a conservative replacement, whether it's Kavanaugh or somebody else, or whether they'll move more quickly sort of to gobble up some of the precedents and overturn them more expressly and dramatically. Mm-hmm. But the abortion right, as significant as it is for all of the reasons that it's significant, is not the only issue on which Justice Kennedy was a pivotal vote. There are cases not only involving reproductive rights and women's rights, but also famously now his major gay right, lesbian and gay rights jurisprudence, including the right to marry decision, cases involving the death penalty, cases involving the war on terror, and last but certainly not least, among others that one could list. You know, there are questions of affirmative action, and I would also add, I guess, voting rights and gerrymandering. These are really important issues that are already percolating. And some of the question is what Steve was talking about, which is how conservative is Judge Kavanaugh, and would he be as a justice on the Supreme Court? There's a difference between being a court of appeals judge and a Supreme Court justice. But some of the question is how much respect he will show to the existing precedents that were decided by this swing vote, Justice Kennedy.
Which is another kind of conservatism. Not what we're thinking about typically, but where is hesitant. And that's what you were talking about, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mark has it exactly right. We're going to go into this and all the way through the confirmation process, and Brett Kavanaugh is going to tell us, as he did last night, that precedent matters and judges have to have respect for precedent. And I think he's probably likely to be confirmed, although I share what I think is Mark's maybe asterisk next to that. Mm-hmm. But we're not really going to know. I mean, he's going to tell us he respects precedent, and he's going to get on the court, and then he's going to do what he wants to do. And there isn't really any way to know. And I think Mark's absolutely right that the difference between a federal appeals court judge and a Supreme Court justice is exactly that. Point: a Supreme Court justice can overrule precedent and explain why a federal appeals court judge has to abide by precedent.
But one thing I would follow up on Steve's point to say is, even if it is the case, and we can, I think, for discussion, assume it's going to be the case, that Judge Kavanaugh, as a Justice Kavanaugh, if we get there. Would be respectful of precedent, maybe in a way that some of the other conservative justices are not.
Alito, for instance. Okay.
But there's respecting precedent, and there's also respecting precedent, meaning you can be respectful of precedent, but also do creative things with it along the way. You can sort of take and honor a principle of an earlier decision in such a way as to sort of bow in its direction, to pay it respect while subtly changing the direction of a rule. It's not flashy. It's hard to get it up to the level of broad public consciousness and conversation, but there are subtle moves that justices can make while respecting precedent, while also sort of starting to turn a case or a line of cases in a different direction.
Is that a good example of that, the 1992 decision regarding reproductive rights and what states can do?
Yeah, so here's an example. And you can do this in either more conservative or more mm-hmm. liberal direction. So the case from 92 that you're talking about is Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania against Casey. There's a famous dividing line in that case between pre-viable viability and post-viability abortions. And the court in that case, in a joint opinion authored by Justices O'Connor, Souter, and Kennedy, announced what's called an undue burden standard. And it's a standard that sort of subsequent cases have been trying to sort of give meaning to. The latest case in the reproductive rights line, it's called Whole Woman's Health against Hallerstedt, is a case that took that test and gave it new life and new energy in ways that concerned the conservative justices. Justice Thomas complained that under this new understanding of this undue burden test, we were effectively moving back in the direction of Roe. So liberal justices can take a test and give it teeth in a way that makes it a much more liberal kind of decision, just as now one might expect that some of the conservative turn could pay respects to that same test, but start to sort of remove some of the teeth from it so that it isn't as stringent a test in terms of the legitimacy of state laws restricting abortion as would be the case under the current application or understanding of the test.
We have a Facebook comment from Lisa. She says, we need more women and people of color on the bench. Another middle-aged white guy is not what we need, regardless of whether or not he is an experienced legal professional, an independent thinker. Steve Wermiel, it doesn't seem like Donald Trump, was really taking that into consideration. There was, correct me if I'm wrong, but at least one woman in the top four possibilities, but no luck.
I don't think diversity made Donald Trump's top 10 list of, right. factors for this nomination.
Yeah, yeah. And does it matter ultimately, Mark Spindelman?
Sure. I mean, it matters in all sorts of ways. It matters in terms of life experiences that individuals bring as justices to the Supreme Court. It matters in terms of how they understand what's happening and the consequences and the meanings of cases and decisions that the issue. And it matters in terms of the conversation that the justices have among themselves. And it also, of course, matters in terms of the public sense that the court is not a political body, because it looks like the country and doesn't look like, the country was or the leadership of the country was 10, 15, 20 years ago or more.
But I would just add, Kavanaugh went out of his way last night to point out that more than half of his law clerks have been women, which I suppose was his way of there's not much he can do about the diversity issue. He is who he is, and he is who Trump nominated, but he sort of threw that out to try to reassure us that he appreciates the need for more involvement of women at the top of the profession. Whether that actually makes any difference in what he does on the court remains to be seen.
He hired a lot of women. He's not a woman himself, but he hired a lot of women.
Right.
Kim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kim.
Hi, I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
I have a question that bothered me. It seems to me that if you repeal Roe v. Wade, that you are doing it on based on the Christian religion that says that goes back to the Bible that says this is murder. And I don't understand why it seems to me that this would be unconstitutional, because the country is based on saying that we're not going to establish any religion. And it seems to me that it should be on viability. And before viability, a woman should be allowed to choose to have an abortion if she doesn't believe that she is murdering a person. And I'm not sure I understand why this isn't considered unconstitutional if they repeal it. Or use birth.
Oops, sorry. But go ahead, Steve Wermiel.
Conservatives don't necessarily have to rely on religion to decry the right to abortion. They can argue, as many have, that the right to abortion simply isn't in the Constitution. The right to abortion is sort of built on a ladder of implications. First, the Supreme Court said there was a right to privacy for married couples, and then the Supreme Court said that right to privacy included a right to contraception for unmarried couples, and then the Supreme Court said, well, that right to privacy also must include the right of a woman to decide whether to continue a pregnancy or not. And conservatives can argue for non-religious reasons that whole process was illegitimate, that there was no basis for finding those rights to be implicit in the Constitution. Whether they actually believe that or whether they're pursuing the influence of their religious views, I don't think they would give the ammunition to turn it into a religious fight.
Mark Spindleman.
I think that that's just right.
Kim, thanks a lot for that call. Dale in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Dale.
Hi. My question relates to the use of the word conservative. It seems to me in the public discourse these days, conservative is kind of a euphemism for protecting hate speech or white nationalism or this whole ilk. And if conservative and a judge relates to that leaning that the country is already going to, what might we expect out of this new nominee?
Is that necessarily what you mean when you refer to conservative, Mark Spindleman?
Not I, but I certainly can understand why, given the use of the language of conservatism, why in political terms it might include that. For me, anyway, I'm when I'm talking about a conservative Supreme Court justice, I'm talking about it sort of as a kind of counterpoint to the liberal justices who understand the Constitution in general terms to be an evolving document whose meaning changes, the meaning of which changes over time, as opposed to conservative justices, many of whom have increasingly organized themselves around a way of reading the Constitution known as originalism, where the idea is the meaning of the Constitution is what it was at the time, and in terms of nowadays, it's often in terms of the public understandings of the terms of the Constitution, although originalism is a very complicated discourse. So for me, it's more about outlook and attitude towards how one approaches reading the Constitution. And so conservatism is a kind of legal or jurisprudential concept as I'm
right.
Using it.
Steve Wormiel agreed.
Yeah, I often tell people that I think of conservatism as a capital C conservatism and a small c conservatism. The small c is somewhat quaint and old-fashioned these days, and it's more, I think, what Mark is talking about. Mm-hmm. It's deferring to the other branches of government to make policy choices. It's respecting precedent. It's envisioning a narrower role for the court because it's not the elected part of the government. Capital C is the Republican platform and party values and so on. And I think we have a number of justices who are kind of in the middle. They share some of those small c conservative values, but they also are influenced by the politics of the Republican Party of the last 40 years.
Dale, thanks a lot for that call. Anybody else out there have a question or comment? We're talking about the nominee to the United States Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, was going to be undergoing confirmation hearings in the Senate probably sometime in September, late August, September. My guests are Stephen Wormiel. He's a professor in constitutional law and associate director of the Summer Institute on Law and Government at American University, Washington College of Law, and also Mark Spindleman, professor of law for the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, too. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Brett Kavanaugh is the President Trump's pick to replace Justice Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. He took 2 weeks to vet and select a 53-year-old circuit court judge for the job. Whether the Senate confirmation goes smoothly is yet to be seen. Retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy was a swing vote during his tenure on the court. Kavanaugh may swing more solidly with a conservative majority if confirmed. Still with us is OSU law professor Mark Spindleman, and also by phone, American University law professor Steve Wormiel. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Steve, what do you look for during these hearings? Is it something, I know you covered the court for The Wall Street Journal for a number of years. Is it different when you're a constitutional scholar and in the shoes you wear now?
I mean, I wish that as a constitutional professor, I wish that we learned more about the court and the nominees from the hearings. But as Joe Biden, when he was still a senator, called it a kabuki dance, where everybody is kind of playing a scripted role to make sure that nothing unravels and everything goes smoothly. So we actually learn very little about the nominee. I think we heard what we're going to learn about Kavanaugh last night. He thinks we should interpret the statutes and the Constitution as written, informed by history, tradition, and precedent. Basically, I think we're going to hear that answer in about 100 different forms for 2 or 3 days, and it tells us very little.
So I don't doubt that that's all exactly right, that what the nominee will actually say will likely not add very much. That seems like a good prospect. But I do think, and I think this is part of the reason that as the news reports were coming out, why the Senate Majority Leader had some questions about proceeding with Kavanaugh's compared to some of the other people whose names were in the pool. Mm-hmm. It's quite a long record. So I expect that there will be a lot of digging that people on senator staffs are, I'm sure they've already started. And so what we will, I assume, learn is what's sort of in the opinions, what the subtle inflections are, particularly those subtle inflections that are capable of being articulated in sort of ways that make the kabuki dance more interesting. And so we'll learn things about his writings. Mm-hmm. Although I'm sure that Steve is right that the answers that Judge Kavanaugh will give back will be quite restrained.
Let's see. I'm going to turn to Donna in Medina. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm wondering if the guest could explain why are justices appointed for life? Why are we stuck with these people for decades? There's no other part of our government where you're appointed for life.
Mark Spindleman?
Steve, go ahead.
Oh, Steve?
Well, I mean, the short answer is it's in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The Article 3 of the Constitution, which is the article about the judiciary, basically says justices shall serve during good behavior, which means they serve as long as they haven't been impeached or done something illegal for which they can be thrown out. So we could amend the Constitution and create term limits, and there are a number of proposals floating around to do that. But the short answer is it comes from the Constitution.
So what's the philosophy that led to that, though? I mean, in the miracle in Philadelphia, what did they talk about when they decided to make it a life term?
I mean, there isn't a lot of record from the convention, but the basic premise is that it preserves the independence of the judiciary. They're not beholden to anybody. They don't have to please anybody. They don't have to seek reappointment and worry about their opinions and how they'll be received in order to get reappointment or approval, and so they have the independence, which is Kavanaugh last night said is a crown jewel of the republic.
Mike in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My question goes back to your discussion of conservatism. And it seems to me that it would be reasonable to look at, as our society changes and our culture changes, to take that into consideration. And so I'm not sure why that's not a very reasonable way to approach it.
So some of the question, Mike, I think is about what the role of the court is in reflecting those sorts of changes. So it's one thing to say, well, as the American people change their minds about issues, that those changes in views can be expressed as public policy, as law, either through the elected branches or through direct forms of democracy like we have here in Ohio. And it's another thing for the justices to be reflecting those changes in constitutional terms in relation to a document that's meant to be a document that serves as the basis for our political and legal order from generation to generation. So some of the conservative views are, well, look, on issues about which people have changed their minds, things like reproductive rights or reproductive justice, things like same-sex marriage, the people can make up their mind and can change the laws if they wish to. But that's a very different thing from the justices of the Supreme Court saying there is a constitutional right, say, to abortion, or there is a constitutional right to marriage that includes a right to same-sex marriage that is something that the people can then not change again later on.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. John in Burlington, Vermont, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, yes. My question was more for the immediate term, in that I was curious if your guests had any idea what the Senate Democrats might be able to do to extend the hearings, or at least delay things to the point through the midterms, considering Mitch McConnell had blocked Garland by saying that the people deserve a voice in the next Supreme Court justice choice.
So,
I'll just take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John. Steve Ramil, I mean, because the Senate Republicans were able to put off confirmation in one case, mean the Senate can put it off in another case?
I mean, I don't think the Senate Democrats have the votes to be able to do that. I think Mark was making the point earlier, which I think is right, is there's a voluminous record here of Kavanaugh's work in the White House, his work with the independent counsel investigating President Clinton, in addition to 300-plus federal appeals court opinions. It's possible that somewhere in there is a some wild card that we don't know about, something that somebody digs up and requires further inquiry and allows the Democrats to slow things down. But short of that, I don't think the Democrats have much ability to really stand in the way. I think McConnell's, the majority leader's timetable, is a pretty ambitious timetable, given that Kavanaugh will have to fill out what will end up being a 1,000-page questionnaire with every case he's ever sat on and every client he ever represented and so on. But if the Senate thinks it can do it, I'm not sure there's much the Democrats can do to get in the way.
Agreed, Mark.
Don't disagree at all. I think it's all in what is or is not in that voluminous record.
He has donated to campaigns, and I guess I was surprised, which I feel sort of naive. I was a political reporter for years, and he donated to campaigns of Rich Cordray here in Ohio. They were fellow clerks for Justice Kennedy. They knew each other in a law firm at one point, I think. Apparently, they've split ways because Brett Kavanaugh's very opposed to the power of the agency that Rich Cordray was the director of for some years. But be that as it may, do those kinds of campaign contributions tell any story? Is that something that we might be looking at, Steve Ramil?
Well, it depends a little bit on how the hearings unfold. But sure. If the Democrats are going after Kavanaugh as this monolithic conservative, it could be the Republicans who say, well, you know, what are you talking about? He donated to Richard Cordray's campaign, and look how even-handed and open-minded he is. The Democrats could attack him for making campaign contributions in the first place, and you know, does that show he's too political? So, you know, that stuff can play out in different directions.
Mark Spindleman, is it unusual for judges to do that? Not necessarily?
It struck me when I heard the news as you were describing it. You know, it's... And I think it would probably play out exactly the way that yeah. Steve is describing. Yeah. I don't know about the political practices in this respect of the federal judiciary.
Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. And could I put you through this scenario? Let's go back to Roe v. Wade, and let's assume that the court does strike it down to say there's no right of privacy, right, and therefore, in effect, we no longer have Roe v. Wade. But at that point, it would then revert to the states to decide what they want to do, as I understand.
Like
it, okay?
It used to be, right?
Yeah, as it used to be. Now, let's carry that a little bit further, and that the court goes beyond that and says an embryo or an unborn baby is a person and therefore entitled to First Amendment constitutional rights. That, in effect, I would think, would prevent the states then from enacting abortion laws.
To follow the reasoning out, if the court were not only to overturn Roe, but then to go to take a much bigger step after that to say that fetuses are persons entitled to constitutional rights, then there would be a powerful case to be made that abortion permissive laws allowing abortions violate the rights of the constitutional persons that the court in that respect would be protecting. But there might still be some balancing that would have to be done between the rights of the pregnant woman and who is also, of course, a person, and the rights of the fetus, who in this hypothetical case that you're imagining the court would say is a person. So it doesn't mean necessarily that everything, any abortion permissive law would go, but it would certainly make the universe of permissible abortion laws smaller than it would be if all the court did was to overturn Roe.
In that scenario that Jim described, Steve, likely, unlikely, what do you think?
I think that's a pretty giant step. You know, I think in reality, nobody knows whether the court will overturn Roe or chip away at it using the undue burden standard that Mark was describing earlier from the Casey decision. But even if they were to overturn Roe, it's a big leap to go the next step and say the fetus is a person, and it raises all kinds of issues the court would have to wrestle with. Is the fetus a person at the moment of conception? Is the fetus a person at the moment of viability? Is the fetus a person at the moment of birth? How do you, as Mark suggested, how do you weigh the constitutional rights of fetal personhood against the constitutional rights of the mother? There's a lot to unpack there that I think the court would not rush into.
I think the court wouldn't rush into it is exactly right. But I will say I just happened to be reading an article that talked a little bit about the history of conservative opposition to abortion. And there's long been a strain of thinking in the right to life movement that fetuses are not just persons, but also ought to be understood to be constitutional persons with constitutionally protected rights. So although it's far off for the court to reach that conclusion, I wouldn't be surprised if that push gained steam after a decision overturning Roe.
Mark Spindleman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Mark Spindleman, professor of law at Ohio State University. Also, Stephen Wermiel, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Stephen Wermiel is professor of constitutional law at the Washington College of Law at American University. That's it today on this topic. I'm sure we'll be following it as we move along. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.